You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our state this week. Our panel today, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, Margaret Carmel with Idaho Press, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio. Welcome to the program, everyone.
Thank you.
Hey, Gemma.
And joining us on the phone live for a few minutes is Nate Eaton. Nate is a reporter at EastIdahoNews.com. Nate has been covering the case of the two missing children in Rexburg since the fall. In fact, Nate was basically the first reporter to start reporting on this. And Nate, there was a big development in the case yesterday, but I'd like for you to kind of give to try to give us a quick background on this case, because it has made national headlines, but I am sure there are still some people who are not up to date on this case.
Yeah, so I guess the core center of this case is these two missing kids, JJ and Tylee. Their mother, Lori, was living in Arizona when her husband was shot and killed by Lori's brother. Then Lori's brother died, and his death is under investigation. So you have the mother who loses her husband to a gunshot wound, shot by the brother. They then move up to Idaho, this moment with her two kids, and the kids vanish. The last time they're seen is in September. Lori then marries a man named Chad Daybell from the Rexburg area in November, and his wife died in October in her sleep. Originally, it was from natural causes, but police have now said that's not the case, and her death is under investigation. So Lori marries this other man named Chad. They take off to Hawaii December 1st. The kids have not been seen since September, and the couple, the newlyweds, have been living in Hawaii. That's kind of the 30-second version, as you mentioned. There's so many twists and turns in this case, but that's kind of the basics.
So, okay, so from there, I mean, you actually, Nate, ended up going over to Kauai when law enforcement found out where they were. You were able to have an interaction with Lori and Chad.
Yeah, about a month ago, we had learned that they were in Hawaii. The kids still missing. And we were ready to go over there and talk to them. And the police asked us if we could hold off a little bit. They didn't want to spook them. And we got a tip one Thursday. The next day we were on a plane. And then the following Sunday, when they were served with some arrest warrants on the vehicle they were driving and their home, they were not arrested, but we were able to approach them. And I asked them, I believe, 29 times in 3 minutes, where are your children? Some sort of version of that mm-hmm. question. And they did not answer any of those questions. And that's, I think, when it was kind of thrust into the national spotlight, because here are these parents on the beach in Hawaii with their kids missing, and there has been no sign of these kids anywhere.
And then from there, there was a judge in Madison County, in Rexburg, correct, said that Lori had to produce the children.
Yeah, they gave her 5 days to get the kids to Rexburg, either to the police department or to the Department of Health and Welfare. This was after they had told her multiple times, FaceTime the kids with us, you know, put them on FaceTime or take a photo of them with today's newspaper, something like that. They gave her plenty of opportunities to somehow produce that these children are alive and well. That did not happen. Lori never showed up in Rexburg with the kids by January 30th, the deadline. And so a lot of people since then have been saying, why hasn't she been arrested? She violated that court order. Well, that was a misdemeanor court order. And, you know, a lot of times you're not extradited mm-hmm. over misdemeanors. And all of that changed yesterday.
Right. And so also, we should say that then a week ago today, Dateline NBC did a 2-hour investigation on this. And Nate, you were part of the story. I mean, you were interviewed for this. And talk about that as well, because it seems maybe, you know, with your reporting, with Dateline reporting, there seemed to be maybe some more pressure on the authorities.
Yeah, I think the fact once this hit national news and was being talked about, especially on such a well-watched show as Dateline, the authorities were realizing that there's a lot of people that care about this. And I do want to say, I have to give credit to Dateline. A lot of times, you know, as local reporters who are on the line today, that local news is kind of where it's at, where the reporters are doing the dirty work every single day. And sometimes these stories get the national spotlight, And oftentimes the national outlets just ignore the local folks. They kind of do their thing. They parachute in, they parachute out. But Dateline has been very good to work with, giving us credit, wanting to make sure that we kind of work together as a team. And I think they told the story very fairly. And as far as the law enforcement, you mentioned, did it create pressure? I think what they were doing, the police, is they did not want to mess this case up. They did not want to go in too early if they didn't have all their ducks in a row. And the court documents that we got this morning, 14 pages of what the police did to try to get Lori to produce her children, wow, step after step after step after step. And she consistently failed, according to these documents, to produce those kids. And it's almost as if they were building their case in these documents to say, now it is time to charge her. Now it's time to get her into custody.
Okay, so then take us to yesterday and this major development in the case.
So it's been interesting this week because Lori and Chad actually left Kauai and went to Maui, another island in Hawaii, for 2 days earlier this week. A lot of people thought, well, what are they doing that for? And then they came back, and they were spotted at rental car counters. They were spotted in the airplane holding hands, and we had people sending us photos of their every move, it seemed. And yesterday, police went to their house in Kauai yesterday afternoon, and they arrested Lori and booked her. They charged her with two counts of desertion and non-support of children, along with some misdemeanors, resisting and or obstructing an officer, solicitation of a crime, and contempt of court. She was booked on $5 million bond, and we're hearing that at 1 o'clock today, Hawaii time, she will appear for her first court appearance and likely be extradited back to Idaho. Whether that happens this weekend or next week or in a few weeks, that's yet to be known, but looks like she'll be coming back here to face those charges.
So, Nate, tell us about what some of those those court documents said, because as you said, 14 pages, and I believe one part that I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, is Lori telling her new in-laws back in, I believe, November-ish, that she was, quote, an empty nester. They didn't even know that she had these two children.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that she had said, that she was an empty nester. Chad had also mentioned to others that that Lori didn't have any children, any young children. The other interesting fact we learned from the documents that were just released today is that Kylie was last seen at Yellowstone National Park on September 8th. The police were actually able to get a photograph from the National Park Service of Kylie there at the park. That is the last time anyone has seen her or that there is documented evidence that she was alive and living on that date. Some of the other interesting tidbits we have is that Lori was apparently, according to these documents, using Kylie's bank card and using money well after that September 8th date. Also, that Chad received $430,000 in life insurance when his wife passed away. At least $430,000. That's what the document said. So a lot of people say, how are they living over in Hawaii? Well, he had at least $430,000 to his disposal from her life insurance policy. And then there's a lot of other stuff that we have heard before that, you know, when police went and did this welfare check here in Rexburg at the house, Lori said they're with a friend, they're with a relative. At one point, the friend that Lori said that they were with called police and said, listen, Chad and Lori both called me, and they both told me to lie to you and say that I have the kids, but I have not seen them in months.
So, Nate, as you mentioned, she will be arraigned this afternoon, Hawaii time. We are waiting, though, to find out when that extradition back to Idaho will happen, correct? No paperwork has been filed that we know of yet?
No, not that we know of. And it is one of those things where even the prosecutor here tells us he doesn't know the exact specifics. They've got to get through this hearing today, and then the Kauai police are holding a news conference. I would imagine at this hearing, they will then set forth the next steps to bring her back here to Idaho.
Nate, I want to thank you for joining us. Your reporting on this has been excellent, honestly. You know, kudos to you and your team for taking this case from the very beginning before it made any headlines anywhere, and your reporting bringing this entire case to light.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Jimmy, I want to start with the latest on the transgender issues that are going on at the State House. Quickly kind of give us the background of that and then where we are right now.
Yeah, where to start? I mean, we have three bills. Mm-hmm. Earlier today, we had a public hearing in a House committee on one that would forbid anyone, but especially the one that, or the group of people that this seems to be targeting the most, are transgender people who want to change the gender marker on their birth certificate. This has been the subject of a federal court order over the past roughly 2 years, where the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, at one time, not in the recent past, forbid them from doing so, and admitted in court documents that, yeah, this is probably unconstitutional, but it still had to work its way through the federal court system. And then they said, yes, you have to do this because you are denying transgender people under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So this bill that was in committee today, which passed out, it's going to the House floor. This would ban pretty much anyone from changing anything on their birth certificate unless it's some kind of factual error, is what they said. Let's say you have Representative Julianne Young, who's bringing this. She's saying it's not violating this court order because no one would be able to do it without it being a factual change, and therefore it's not actually targeting anyone, especially transgender people. And she's saying that this is necessary to protect the safety of our citizens. She didn't really elaborate necessarily
on what that meant.
However, you had someone, Lindsay Zaya, who works for the conservative Madison Liberty Institute in Rexburg, although she didn't identify herself as someone who worked there. She brought up bathrooms, locker rooms, you know, public safety issues for girls and women in the general public. As of, let's see, January 31st, from April 6, 2018 until the end of January last month, you had 176 applications from or through the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare to change the gender markers on their birth certificates. And no one in this hearing cited any problems, whether it be sexual violence against a girl or woman in a bathroom, locker room, et cetera.
And then where are we with the transgender issue for female athletes?
Sure. So that was also in a House committee earlier this week. We had 2 days of testimony, hours and hours, overwhelmingly opposed to this bill. This would make it so transgender women and girls could not play on sex segregated teams, either in a K-12 public school or at the collegiate level.
K-12.
Correct. Yeah. So even though the organization that oversees Idaho high school sports, they have a policy, the NCAA has a policy saying that, hey, as long as you have been on hormone replacement therapy for at least a year, you're good to go. You can play on these teams. It's okay. Supporters of the bill are really afraid that these top-level high school and collegiate athletes who are trans women are going to edge out what they call, you know, biological women. You know, the bill sponsor, Representative Barbara Ehart, said it hasn't been an issue here in Idaho, but it's just around the corner, is the quote. Everyone who was supportive of the bill cited this case out of Connecticut, where you have a federal court lawsuit going on right now, specifically around two Connecticut high school trans girl athletes who are breaking all kinds of records. And you have the parents of three track athletes suing to bar them from competition.
Well, what was the testimony like? I mean, I would assume it had to be, you know, emotional.
Yeah, at times it was very emotional. And you had people, transgender women, testifying about growing up trans and how difficult it was, and how one woman testified saying that, you know, she couldn't play on girls' teams and it really was demoralizing her, and she turned to drugs and alcohol and while she was trying to sort all this out, and sports really would have helped her, but she spent 10 years as an alcoholic and is finally recovering and getting her life together. But some of the testimony was really powerful, and some of the testimony was really, you know, scientific, and talked about some of the tests that are in this bill would be very difficult to determine for Some children, we heard testimony from a transgender father whose child, is an intersex child at birth through through their genetics at birth, and when their child grows up, it's going to be very difficult to determine whether this child is a boy or a girl based on these tests through genetic tests and pelvic exams and blood tests. And so there was a lot of testimony against it. We had doctors testifying. We had teachers testifying. We had parents and youth testifying. So it was a really powerful testimony over 2 days.
Yeah. And we should say that as far as the bill to ban trans women from competing on sports teams, that does not, like you said, actually flesh out the whole intersex issue. However, the birth certificate bill does have a carve out for those who are intersex or have some kind of chromosomal, deformities or however you want to categorize that. So you can go back and change that on that specific bill.
But it is fascinating to think about, having even scientific data at this testimony.
Yeah, and some study that was brought up by supporters of the bill, actually, it's this new study from New Zealand that was published last year in the Journal of Medical Ethics that seems to suggest that there are lingering physical advantages for trans women, especially after puberty, even if they are taking these testosterone suppressant drugs, that regardless of that, they still have, if you go by the International Olympic Committee level of acceptable testosterone in the bloodstream, that's still 6 times higher than the average cisgendered woman. They inherently met, like people who were born male have inherently larger hearts, bone density, ligament strength, muscle development, which can aid in recovery, strength, speed, all of that stuff. However, the study does say that it's important to have inclusionary policies for transgender athletes, and it suggests that maybe there should be an algorithm that takes into account all of these factors, socioeconomic backgrounds, to match up athletes within each specific sport, and not necessarily try to make some kind of binary decision.
So we've had the testimony. So what happens next in this process?
It goes to the House floor. It passed out of committee with a due pass recommendation on party lines. And so now it goes to the House floor for a vote. I don't know exactly if it's scheduled yet for the House floor.
Not that I've seen, no.
Margaret, I want to bring you into the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about the proposal to allow taxation of private companies in Idaho that lease public lands.
An issue being brought by kind of an unlikely partnership in the legislature, Democratic Representative John Gannon from Boise and House Majority Leader Representative Mike Moyle from Starr. And they would like to get a constitutional amendment passed that would allow private companies that are leasing public space, like at the airport or in public-owned buildings, like there's one particular office building that Boise State that is looking to purchase, that they could collect taxes from that. And their argument is being able to collect taxes from these private companies that are in public space would help with the current tax shift that's going on, where commercial property is having lower and lower share of the tax burden, and it's falling more and more on residential owners. The idea is, okay, well, we've got all these businesses that are in these public buildings not paying taxes. Let's open the door to being able to tax them, and that should help shift the tax burden.
Because I believe, as you mentioned, the airport, wasn't it it's the Chevron gas station on
yes.
the airport property?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The airport owns the land underneath that Chevron station, which is not taxed. However, the building itself is owned by, I believe, Airport Chevron Inc. Is the actual name of the company, and they are taxed on the value of that building, which is north of $1 million.
Okay, but not
of assessed value,
but not paying tax on the physical land.
Correct, which is prime real estate. The airport also owns, I believe, land that has the hotels and motels and a lot of other businesses around there.
Oh, right,
as well.
In that area. Mm-hmm. So, Margaret, where are we next in the process then of this?
So, to pass a constitutional amendment, you have a really steep climb to do that. So it's passed out of committee. It should be heard on the House floor soon. I haven't seen it scheduled yet. But that should be, and if it passes the House, it'll have to get through the Senate and then go to a vote of the people in November. And it will have to get a two-thirds majority from both chambers. So this is a higher standard than you would see a normal bill coming through. And one of the sticking points for this, particularly in the city of Boise, is depending on how legislation is written later, it could remove the city's ability to do real estate deals with private developers to build affordable housing, where they say, okay, if you build an affordable housing development, you won't have to pay the property taxes on the land, and that will help keep prices low and will entice developers to build affordable housing through these public-private partnerships. And depending on how legislation is later written, it could block that, which has really kind of been the city's, their one strategy that they've really been pushing on, to saying, okay, we can't do rent control in Idaho. We can't do inclusionary zoning where we require developers to build affordable units. They can't do a lot of the things that places in Portland, like Portland or Seattle, are doing to combat the housing crisis. But we can do public-private partnerships with real estate incentives, and this could cause a problem for that.
Well, and we're also seeing that, Margaret. I mean, that's such a good point in the sense, too, that a lot of the affordable housing that we're seeing right now is also coming up close to downtown to help with that homeless population who tend to congregate in downtown areas. And that's incredibly expensive real estate.
Well, it's not even just affordable housing that's targeted at those experiencing homelessness. Really, what they're trying to do is they're trying to build affordable housing that's going to target people at a variety of incomes, where you're making, around between $30,000 and $40,000 a year. And the reason that they're targeting stuff in downtown is what's called this idea of transit-oriented development,
right,
where you build housing near public transit so folks can get around to their jobs, the grocery store, things they need to do without a car. Because ideally, according to the federal government housing standards, you should only be paying 30%, a certain amount of your income, towards housing and transportation. So if you put someone in downtown where they don't need a car, then they can, they won't be
less burdened. Of their income will have to go to things like that. So as you mentioned, this has a long hill to climb. But where are we right now then in this process at the State House?
It's passed out of committee. And so we'll have to see what the House of Representatives has to say about this. And then it will go onto the Senate side. And if it passes both chambers with a two-thirds majority, then it will be on the ballot in November.
So property taxes. I mean, Scott, you were on the program earlier this week talking about this. But Jimmy, get us up to date on what's going on with Democrats at the State House and basically crying foul over property taxes.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats, who make up a very small minority of the Idaho legislature, about 20% in both the House and Senate, they were basically saying that Republicans are holding back their proposals to try to address this property tax crisis that everyone across the state is talking about, from north to south to east to west, right? And so in a press conference, you had House Minority Leader Alana Rubel saying that the GOP is basically not targeting the root causes of ballooning property taxes, with House Majority Leader Mike Moyle's property tax freeze. That's still set to be voted on in the House next week. It's been kind of delayed this week, actually, which kind of brings up the question, well, what's wrong with it? Like, why? What is going on? What are the conversations behind the scenes? Anyway, so you have Alana Rubel calling this a fake non-solution, distracting from the legislatures who actually caused the current property tax problems, in her words. She's listing off things like crowded jails and prisons. She wants to really get sentencing reform done to address that, since you have the state prison system sending either inmates out of the state to different private prisons, or you have them going to county jails and taking up space there. And then you have county jails being like, well, they're not reimbursing us the true cost of what this is, and therefore county taxpayers are picking up the rest of it. So she's pointing to 7 bills, some of which are bipartisan, that aren't being considered yet. Some of them haven't even been printed. And so those would include things like changing how the sales tax is distributed to cities and counties with revenue sharing. Internet sales tax revenue that's coming in is actually going to a different account than the general fund, and that is earmarked only for tax relief at this moment. So this bill would kind of distribute that among cities and counties as well. You have changes to the circuit breaker program for low-income individuals, seniors, and veterans. That would kind of bump up the income limits for that. Capping, increasing residential market values by 10%, indexing the homeowner's exemption, all of these things. Taking a look at sales tax exemptions, which at least from Representative Steve Birch, this is his bill that would create a committee to study all of this. And according to him, last year in 2019, you had almost $2.5 billion worth of money, sales tax revenue, that the state could be taking in,
but is not
because it's exempted. We're talking things like when you go to your barber or your salon to get your haircut, that is tax exempt. You know, stuff that farmers and ranchers purchase, that can also be tax exempt. And we should say $2.48 billion is more than the entire education budget, K through 12 and colleges and universities combined last year. So that's a lot of money on the table out of a $3.9 billion budget in 2019 that we're looking at.
And during this news conference, Margaret, they brought up these bills and saying basically, like, as Jimmy mentioned, nothing's being looked at.
Right. They said that multiple of the bills have either been refused to be considered by a chairman and they're, quote unquote, sitting in a drawer in committee, or they are still talking with the chairmans to try to see if they can come forward. None of the only property tax bill we have heard in the House is the one we talked about in the last segment that would be the constitutional amendment on taxing those private companies and public buildings. And then Mike Moyle's property tax freeze, which even he admits would all it would do was cap property tax collection increases from local governments, but it still wouldn't solve the problem of increasing tax assessments and bills for residential property owners. All it would do was just limit the ability of local governments to take in additional revenue. It would not freeze your property taxes.
Yeah, and we should say that Republicans have consistently said that this isn't necessarily because the property tax levy rates are going up. They say that that's attributable to the cities and the counties spending more money and increasing their budgets. And so they're saying, well, why not tighten your belts? You guys need to actually rein in your spending instead of jacking up these property taxes.
And I spoke with Representative Moyle earlier this week in a reaction to the Democrats' press conference. And what he told me was, he said, I think there's a difference of philosophy between us and the Democrats. The Democrats are looking for more money to give to the cities and counties. We're telling them to cut their budgets. And I think that's really, you know, a different look at that. But the testimony for this property tax freeze bill was overwhelmingly from local governments saying, we can't cut anymore. We're trying, especially for counties that have mostly state-mandated things like running a public defender's office, building a courthouse, running a jail, lots of other things like that, where they're saying, we're having tons of population growth. We need to build a fire station. We need to build hire more attorneys. And there were countless examples of folks from local government saying, if you freeze our property taxes, I won't be able to hire staff that I need to keep up with the people flooding into this state.
Yeah, you had the city of Nampa financial administrator say, hey, our police department is running at 2010 staffing levels still, 10 years later. Yes. And they said that they need to hire a few dozen more police officers because they hear from their constituents that keeping crime down and public safety is one of their number one priorities, aside from streets, if I remember correctly.
But it's interesting, as you brought up, Margaret, that even if you freeze that, that doesn't actually freeze your property taxes and what we will all pay.
Right, because the portion of taxes, of tax value, that residential is making up of the total tax collection keeps going up and business values keep going down. So that means every year, the share that your house might have of the overall taxes is going to be, it's getting more and more valuable in relation to businesses, which means even if the amount that the cities are going to collect stays flat, your house is still going to keep going up in value in relation to businesses and maybe other houses around you, and your bill is still going to spike. And that's really the multiple folks, including policy analysts from the Idaho Policy Institute at Boise State, have said that is really the underlying cause of the property tax epidemic that's going on with people not being able to pay their bills. I know in sections of Boise, we've had values spike 40% in places like, you know, the Bench is a hot spot. The North End is a hot spot of, you know, really close into downtown. And people are seeing double digit assessment increases year over year over year. And just by freezing that property tax collection, it's not going to stop that.
And Scott, you wrote a really interesting opinion piece for The Statesman earlier this week. You were on the program Wednesday. But for folks that may not have listened to that segment, talk a little bit about what's working, but what possibly could work in the future. Because I think you brought up something really fascinating about school districts.
Right. And, you know, property tax bill, your property tax bill is made up of a lot of different pieces. Some of it is the city, some of it is the county, some of it is school district, some of it is the mosquito abatement district, some of it is College of Western Idaho. And it varies from city to city. So if you live in the city of Boise, the city of Boise portion of your property tax bill is about 43% of your bill. Over in Star, in Mike Moyle's district, the school district makes up 32% of the bill, and the city of Star only makes up 12% of the bill. So having that property tax freeze is going to be much more acute, you know, in the city of Star, but it's going to have less of an impact on an individual's property tax bill. And so one of the things we talked about, particularly for the elderly and disabled and veterans and people who are blind, is that you have the circuit breaker available. And so there's only about half of the people who qualify for it actually take advantage of it. But the other thing, and I think the Democrats have mentioned this, but the only way we are able to pay for new school buildings in fast-growing school districts like West Ada is to pass a bond that's paid back by property taxpayers. So when you look at that 31% of your tax bill going to the school district, most of that is going toward a bond to pay for new schools. And so that's really the definition of growth not paying for growth, because you've got existing taxpayers who are paying for new buildings necessitated by people who are moving in. So if you are able to come up with some mechanism like allowing school districts to collect impact fees, which we are not able to do right now, it's not in state code to allow that. If you just add those two words, school districts, to that portion of state code that allows the collection of impact fees, now school districts would be able to start collecting those impact fees upon development and help offset some of the costs of the construction of those new buildings.
Because other entities can collect impact fees, correct?
Right. Cities and fire districts and the county and ACHD, mm-hmm. they can collect impact fees. And they do. And over the past couple of years, a lot of cities have recognized that they can start doing this to a larger extent. Caldwell and Nampa, Meridian rejiggered its impact fee ordinance to try to collect more based on square footage. So the cities are kind of waking up. CUNA, the fire district out there, they're starting to collect impact fees, but school districts still can't do that.
Yeah, Margaret and Jimmy, is this something that's even being talked about at the State House?
Not that I've seen, no.
No.
No, we asked the governor. We had the governor in our office this week, and he said he hasn't seen any RS on it. So it's just, again, I wrote a column a couple weeks ago saying that these conversations have been going on. The solutions are out there, but the legislators are not, they're not proposing these. They're not talking about it. And this is one of the biggest things I think they could do to alleviate property tax bills.
Because in your article, I mean, you even talked about how, I mean, Justin, in Boise, in what was it, February, January, what the median home price is now?
Right, it's $365,000 is the median home price in January in Ada County.
And it just keeps going up because we broke a record from December. I mean, every month it seems to be more.
Right. And that's an indication of people moving in to this area. And we're a high growth area. And that requires, so West Ada School District, when they testified to the legislature, they said that they're adding the equivalent of one elementary school per year. 600 students per year are coming into the West Ada School District every year.
Wow.
And so imagine trying to build an elementary school every year. And the only way you can do that is by having the property taxpayers pay for it.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today and getting us up to date on all of this. Our panel today, Margaret Cromwell with Idaho Press, Scott McIntosh with Idaho Statesman, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters.